This week in Retronauts, the Mouse Police Never Sleep. Welcome to another episode of Retronauts. This one follows directly on the heels of Iron Man. As promised, we've segued. Yes. Hi, I'm Jeremy Parrish. And segueing here with me, though not on a segue, it is... All right.
Sorry. Benj Edwards.
And...
Chris Sims, here to talk about how Pac-Man is a Metroidvania.
Sorry, Jeremy cracks
You're me. You're wrong. So yes, we are going to talk about Pac-Man. But not about Metroidvanias. No, sir. There's none of that this episode. We are talking about the golden silver age of arcades and the games that Namco created in 1983, maybe through 1987, but I'm guessing not, because that last episode went way too long and cut into this episode's time. Sorry, everyone. But anyway, we have previously covered the early days of Namco, starting in their sort of weird and not very well-known black and white games from the 70s, and all the way through their big hits of 1980, 81, and 82. And now we're getting into an era where maybe the hits aren't quite so great. I feel like there's a story here that, you know... Sega and Namco have always been kind of positioned as rivals in arcade development. You had other big companies making arcade games like Data East and Taito, but I feel like Sega and Namco have always been kind of like the two big names in classic arcade games, and you know, coming from Japan. I think we learned with our Sega episodes that they started out okay and... took a while to kind of find their voice. But in like 1985, 86, Sega became Sega. And that was amazing. Namco, I think, was Namco pretty much right out of the gates. Pac-Man, Galaga, Zevius, that kind of thing. And now we're getting into sort of some doldrums where things in the early 80s, mid 80s, not so great. There's some good stuff here, but there's also some very bad stuff. And some very like, what are they doing stuff? And so I'm curious to hear kind of at the end of this, what you guys think of this era of Namco games, because some of these games have been collected in compilations, but a lot of them have just been left to die. And this is a company that is very, very, very proactive about preserving its classics and republishing them and keeping them in circulation in some form. So when games like these don't show up on any compilations ever, I feel like that means something. So anyway, I've been talking a lot. What do you guys think?
I think it makes a lot of sense that there is a kind of fallow period for Namco.
You think they were letting their fields lay fallow?
Well, I mean, what do you do after you make Pac-Man?
Actually, you know what?
Plant corn.
You know what? I think saying that this is a fallow period is fair, because around 1983, 84, Namco was starting to look to home game development. Mm-hmm. They made it big on Famicom. Like, you know, they were one of the first third parties to support Nintendo, and Pac-Man was a huge hit for them. Tower of Juraga was a massive hit for them on Famicom. So I think they were starting to look toward home development and say, oh yeah, we should do stuff on game consoles. So maybe that is why their arcade development sort of suffered by comparison. That's a great, great turn of phrase. Well done.
Thank you. Yeah.
No, thank you.
I don't know what was going on internally in Namco, what happened with the development teams and whatever. I feel like this is like they may have hit those early hits unexpectedly, and then they're just sort of like, how do we follow that up? Like, we accidentally created two or three incredible games that are just blockbusters. And so there a lot of these next games, they're trying to follow up on them in some way or another. And, you know, I don't know if they're re- trying to recreate the success, but they're sort of iterations of those earlier games.
Yeah, and I think the way that they iterate on those things is really interesting, as we'll see going forward.
So let's just jump straight in and kind of pick up on the last really of the sort of classic arcade Namco franchises that we didn't touch on last time, if I'm not mistaken, and that's Mappy. Did we talk about Mappy last time? I checked back through the previous episode and I did not hear it mentioned.
I feel like we've talked about Mappy as friends.
We have. I mean, it's Mappy's dear to our hearts, but in terms of professionals speaking on a podcast, I feel like we have not yet touched on this. I think we stopped at Zevius last time.
I thought I mentioned it maybe briefly last
time. Maybe you mentioned it, but we haven't given it a proper discussion. And I do feel like Mappy is one of those cases that you were talking about, Benj, where they were looking at their previous hits and saying, okay, we need to build on this. How do we do that? In this case, I think they were building on Pac-Man and saying, like, what if we did Pac-Man but also Donkey Kong? And so you have a game that is a side scroller, but also a maze chase, which, you know, that there was some precedent for that. There was Keystone Capers from, I want to say, Atari in like 1982.
Activision.
Oh, was that Activision? Okay. And then there was also, you know, there was a, what was it called? The Heian Kyo Alien style side scrolling platformer.
Deadly Towers?
No. It's from like 1980. It was by UPL. God, I can't remember. Anyway, it was an early platformer that predates even Donkey Kong, and it's kind of a trap 'em up, and you're not jumping.
Yeah, what platform is it?
It was an arcade game. It was UPL, so.
Huh. Boy, that's an obscure one.
Yeah, I should know UPL. What the name is, but it's totally escaping me, and I'll remember it after we're done recording this podcast, and then I'll be angry at myself, and then people will write in to tell me, oh, that game you were trying to think of that you did think of like months ago. Just, okay, anyway. This is my demon. This is my burden to bear, okay?
Yeah.
Demon in a podcast. Yes. Jeremy Parrish story.
Anyway, Benj, talk about Mappy. I need to stop making my mouth move.
I probably first played Mappy on a Namco collection. Was it on the first Namco
Operation? I don't know exactly how the breakdown of those games was, but it was definitely on, it was either on 1 or 3.
It was also on, I think I played 1, 2, and 3 maybe, and it was also on the first plug-and-play TV games joystick, which was really good. I mean, it was really well done by Jack Specific. And it had Mappy on it, I'm pretty sure. I loved that game.
I want to say that was one of the, you know, the Game Boy Advance NES classics in Japan. Mm-hmm. Those are called Famicom Minis. And I feel like that was one of the releases for Famicom Mini in Japan.
Was Mappy?
Yeah.
Wow. They must have loved it.
I remember writing about it for some reason for 1UP.com in the very early days. So that would have been 2003, 2004. And that's the only reason I can think of. But anyway, yes. They have republished this game. It is considered one of their core classics.
Yeah, all I know is that you play as a mouse in a police uniform, I think. And you run around chasing cat burglars, maybe. Good play on words
there.
Yes.
The villain in Mappy... In the American version, his name is Goro. Okay. He's a cat named Goro.
He's got four arms. He'll rip your spine out.
No.
Yeah.
But in Japan, his name is Nyamko. Nyam being the sound, Nya being the sound that cats make, and Namco being the company. So he's Nyamko.
See.
That's pretty good.
Nyamko.
Pretty good.
Why wasn't he called Nam Meow in the American version?
Nam Meow.
Big missed opportunity.
Meowko.
I don't understand Mappy. Like, on any level. I have a very difficult time wrapping my head around it. You saying that it's like Pac-Man, but also Donkey Kong, really...
Doesn't make any sense.
No, it made me understand it more, because I hadn't considered it like that.
Okay, so Mappy is a side-scrolling game.
No. I'm familiar with it.
I'm saying, like, it is kind of... Like, you get into sort of the weird obscurity that you see in, like, Super Pac-Man, where there's, like, these concepts that I think the developers had these ideas in their mind... And they didn't, like, the games were just too abstract, too limited at the time to properly explain. So it's a side-scrolling platformer, and there are, like, these gaps in the floor that you can drop down, and then use trampolines to bounce to other floors. So you change levels in the maze, not by climbing ladders, but by dropping and then trampolining up to the level you want to go to. But then there's like these things chasing you, and to stop them, there are doors you can open. You like slam the door into them. And there are also microwave ovens, and you can send a microwave oven beam at the cats. And they're trying to rob a museum and stealing art. There's a lot happening in this game. I don't think it holds up as well as Namco wants it to.
I find the iconography very disjointed and confusing.
Well, this is because it's a Japanese game. All this must mean something to Japanese culture that we don't understand. Doors, microwaves, cats, anthropomorphic mouses.
I feel like we have doors, microwaves, and cats over here.
Just not together.
They're not all jumping on trampolines together.
Well, ideally not together.
Yeah. You really don't want to put your cats and your microwaves together.
I do think what's interesting to me about Mappy, and putting in the context of Pac-Man meets Donkey Kong, is that the next few years, like the early 80s output of Namco, is like sitting in on the brainstorming session for what they're going to do with Pac-Man next, except every single idea that was thrown out was made into a game.
Like, yeah, pretty much.
Because it's like, nice, okay, well, what if there was a second Pac-Man who followed you around and took the cherries? And like, what if Pac-Man was Mario? And what if there was what if Pac-Man was a mouse chasing cats? It's all, you can see them iterating on the same idea in different ways. And like, what if Pac-Man was in a castle and it was Tower of Draga? It's really interesting, but I think it leads you to places like Mappy. I know it's a core franchise for Namco. I don't get it.
Yeah, this game has some very, very enthusiastic fans, as I have discovered when I've written negative things about it. So people really love it. So it must connect with people on some level, like really strongly. I'm just not one of those people. Maybe I came into it too late.
I will say this. When I hooked up, that joystick for my kids when they were really little, like when my oldest daughter was 3, I think I let her pick any game she wanted on there. She loved Mappy the most, and she actually played it and really enjoyed it. So something about it resonates.
It definitely has cute characters, and the basic action is fun. It's just kind of strange, and I feel like it's very similar in spirit to Pac-Man, but not as good. And like again, it clearly was a big hit for them, because not only did they follow it up and have continued to republish it, you also had a lot of games that kind of tried to be basically Mappy. There was a Game Boy game that I covered on Game Boy Works, which you can see on YouTube, called The Tasmanian Story, which was by Pony Canyon. And that was actually based on a 1983 game that they developed, or 1984 game. It's extremely similar to Mappy. Like, you have the multi-tiered platforms, and you have the trampolines, and when you're like jumping on a trampoline, bad guys can't hurt you, and you're collecting stuff. So clearly this sparked off some sort of this clone saga of other people making games like it.
I feel like Mappy is building off some sort of cultural archetype that we don't have in America, because it just doesn't make sense to us. I think our games that we like, it seems like it has no rigor, no intellectual consistency to it. Just a weird mishmash of stuff. Cats, microwaves, mice, trampolines, police. Multi-level platforming.
If you want to talk about mishmash, we're going to get to Genpei Tomodin. That is a wacky.
But my greater point is that think about American games that are like Pitfall is based on the idea that you are familiar with, like Indiana Jones, somebody already knew, or a solo adventure going through a jungle. These are ideas we're comfortable with culturally because they're repeated through our culture, through movies and whatever, and stories. And so I have, I've encountered weird Japanese games that make no sense to me, but then they have these ancient mythology of Japan that has weird stuff to us.
I don't think that's what's happening with this, though. I mean, it's like, it's pretty obvious, cats and mice. In this case, the mouse is a policeman, so he has to arrest bad cats. But of course, cats are more dangerous than mice. They're deadly to mice.
Well, maybe they start with the cat burglar thing, and then they're like, okay, the police have to be mice.
I don't know if that phrase actually exists over there.
Yeah,
so.
Katsu.
I feel like the characters themselves, I get it. It's cute cartoon characters. It's just like some of the stuff like doors and microwave ovens and art. Like, why is all of that happening? Trampolines, what?
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't think there's intellectual consistency.
I don't think there's a cultural thing before it. I think it's just like they threw a bunch of stuff together and we're like, what can we depict with, what graphics we have here? But MAPI, again, became sort of a franchise for them. MAPI itself never came to a console in the US that I'm aware of. But on NES, we did get MAPI Land, where they took MAPI and put him in more of like a Mario-style platformer. And then if you jump down the list here, let's go ahead and just talk about the sequel, which is Hopping MAPI. And that is a giant what-the-hell game.
Even more confusing.
This is one of those games where they were just like, yeah, we're not going to do anything with that ever again. I think it did show up on Virtual Console in Japan, but that was it. How do you even describe this game?
It's MAPI on a pogo stick,
right?
Hopping around, sort of semi-isometric.
Yeah, it's like the Zelda three-quarters top-down view. And I get, pogo stick, sure, MAPI is about jumping. But in this case, everyone is on a pogo stick simultaneously, and there's like no maze to it. It's just you're in a big open field, and mice and MAPI and Goro are hopping around on pogo sticks.
And you have to hop on their heads, but like not everybody's heads can be hopped on. And there's items, but sometimes the items hop. I don't get it. This game, the background cycles between like daytime, sunset, and night. So looking at this game is like traveling through time. It's like dissociating.
Like you can find you feel like your life is passing you by.
It's like
play this game,
and MAPI never stops hopping. And you're like, has MAPI been hopping for 36 hours? What nightmare hellscape is this?
I thought you were going to say 36 years or something. Has MAPI been hopping his whole life?
What is time?
Yeah. Like it's a construct. He came out hopping.
Right. So yeah, that was a 1986 game. And I feel like that really does kind of get to the point of like...
I figured it out. He's hopping mad.
I was trying to figure out if hopping MAPI was a pun on hopping mad.
I don't think so. So hopping is apparently like just the Japanese term for a pogo stick. It's the hopping. Hopingu. So
pogo.
So MAPI. It's pogo MAPI.
Does MAPI mean something? The word
I don't think
MAPI
so.
Your name.
Okay. That makes sense. I mean, one of the Kamen Rider Forza abilities is called hopping, and it's a pogo stick.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think it was just like they said, well, you know, the original MAPI was about jumping on trampolines and trying to stop mice from stealing or cats from stealing art. So, you know, the side-scrolling maze single screen arcade game, that doesn't work anymore, so let's do something different. And that's what they came up with. Hmm. And that's Namco in the mid-80s for you, right?
It's
there.
It's a head-scratcher.
Yeah, it's a little weird. So finally, one note on MAPI is that someone added a note here to my notes that says, this is the music that plays in my nightmares. Was that you, Chris?
That was me.
How does that music go?
I can't remember it. I don't like it.
No. That's the music of everyone's dreams.
I'm not going to stop. I'm just kidding.
That's a beautiful dream.
No, I don't. Yeah.
It's a dream full of dinosaurs that belch bubbles.
Yeah.
And they drink martinis. Come on.
Yeah, great the mice. Music great, in great, MAPI great is bad.
Bubble seems more intellectually consistent somehow than MAPI. I don't know why.
I mean, Bubble just leans directly into just full-on fever dream.
Yeah.
And it just owns the bizarreness. And that's great.
Yeah.
So a game that has maybe more intellectual rigor to satisfy you, Benj. Pac-N-Pal, yet another sequel to Pac-Man that yet again is not as good as Pac-Man. The only good Pac-Man sequel was actually made by Americans. That was Pac-Man.
Yeah, it's
true.
It is very hard to improve Pac-Man. It's a very simple concept that was done very well. And
so the only, perfectly the first time.
Yeah, so the only way to make it better is
or almost perfectly.
Different mazes.
Yeah, Ms. Pac-Man, you know? Perfects it. That's fine. But it's pretty much perfect. It's still classic.
Yeah, so, and yeah. So you're stuck with this idea where they keep trying to change it. And, like, again, this is, what if there was a second Pac-Man in the maze with you? It's very...
Except it's not a Pac-Man. It's more like a ghost.
It's a pal.
Yeah, well, it's not even your pal, because the ghost is named Miru. I don't know. I guess it's pal in America. But the ghost, like, Miru, pal, whatever, wanders around the maze kind of on his own, her own, and grabs items and then takes them to the ghost house where you can't get them. Like, the zone in the center of the screen where the ghosts materialize, she takes them there and she drops them off. So you can't get their points. So you have to, like, intercept her and get the points, get the items from her if you want those points.
Okay, so basically what they've done is taken Pac-Man, they add a bunch of stuff that makes no sense at all, and they release it.
Well, this feels like
there's cards, there's shooting, there's,
like... To me, this feels like a sequel to Super Pac-Man, whereas the maze is very sparse, it's not full of dots, there's just, like, some stuff scattered around the maze, and there's lots of locked doors, and instead of getting keys to open the doors this time... You're flipping cards, and that causes the doors to open somehow.
I
think the thought process here was, what if we could make Pac-Man competitive? And so they added a second, like, something moving around the maze competing with you for points, but it's still a single-player game.
Right, yeah. So you're not competing against someone. It kind of feels like they were fumbling toward Pac-Man Versus.
Yeah.
That would come 20 years later.
Yeah.
And would need Shigeru Miyamoto to say, oh, here's what it needs to do. And they were like, well, we have this idea and we know what we want, but we don't know how to get there. And they didn't. And it took 20 years.
Yeah, it's very weird to see them try and improve on Pac-Man over the course of the games.
Why didn't they just try a game where you could play as the monsters to begin with? And
it took,
you
know, Shigeru Miyamoto to come in and say, why can't someone play as the monsters?
Yeah, I mean... I thought that the first time I played Pac-Man. Not that hard. I could be Shigeru Miyamoto.
You could. You look a lot like him.
Thank you.
And you have that youthful pluck. So anyway, yeah, I would describe this as a who asked for this take on Pac-Man.
Yeah, it's a weird... It adds a weirdly oppositional element that goes beyond the ghosts. And the ghosts are so perfect in their simplicity. You know, it's a weird... Again, every idea that they brainstormed was made into a full-on game.
Sometimes I have dreams that involve, like, Pac-Man games that have, like, these massive mazes, and they're always bad, and I'm always like, this game is so bad. It's just because you can't mess with the original design of Pac-Man. You can make it better, like Ms. Pac-Man, but you can't change it, otherwise it stops being good. And it took them until Pac-Man Versus and Pac-Man CE in the new millennium to finally understand that. Otherwise, you have stuff like Pac and Pal.
Are you sure you didn't work at
Professor
Namco?
Professor Pac-Man. What's that?
Are you sure you didn't work at Namco in the 1980s?
I'm positive, because I would never...
It's your dream.
I would never make one of those dream games real, because those are bad games. Even my dreams. I'm like, this sucks.
Professor Pac-Man.
Professor That's Pac-Man. Crazy. At least that,
that
had
the weirdest thing.
Yeah, it's weird. It existed, though.
Yeah.
I think that's it for... Oh, no, there is one more Pac-Man game. Actually, why don't we go ahead and jump ahead to that? Because, Chris... Okay. I know that you love Pac-Man, and I will say that of all the Pac-Man sequels developed by Namco up until like 2003, this is probably the best. It's a kind of rough game and could stand to be revisited and refined to be modernized. But considering that it is a platformer, side-scrolling platformer that predates Super Mario Brothers, it's pretty damn impressive.
It really is. So we're talking about Pac-Land. And
a 1984 game.
1984 is Pac-Land. We
skipped over a couple of games.
It is clear to me at this point. There's a lot going on here, because they clearly have recognized that Pac-Man is a brand, right? And Pac-Man himself, for being a circle with a missing triangle of various sizes, is a beloved character, question mark?
Chris, this is based on the cartoon.
Yeah, it's based on the cartoon.
Yeah, you realize this, right?
Oh, no, I put it in the notes.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so you get...
You're making it sound like they were like, what if Pac-Man were a guy? But no, they looked at the cartoon and said, let's take this American cartoon and base our Japanese video game around America's interpretation of
but
Pac-Man.
But recognizing that Pac-Man is a brand with a beloved character, question mark, leads you to the Pac-Man cartoon, which is... Buck Wild. Have you done an episode on those?
Buck Wild?
The Pac-Man cartoon.
You know,
not Buck Wild, the obscure Milestone Comics character.
I feel like that is one that Bob has led, and I can't say for certain because I know we've done a bunch of Pac-Man type stuff. We've done like Christmas Comes to Pac-Land or whatever. I don't know if we've done the
cartoon.
I love
like the Christmas cartoon. Comes to Pac-Land. Okay.
But anyway, yes, we have definitely touched.
I do.
Same.
We have definitely touched on the Pac-Man cartoon to some degree.
You know about how the first episode of the Pac-Man cartoon is about Pac-Man trying to stop the ghost from killing the president of Pac-Land?
Wow.
The Pac-President?
The Pac-President, yeah.
I see.
Yeah. So it's like probably the saw the candidate. Debut show.
Yeah. He's a member of a political action committee.
No, come on. That was a good joke. Damn it.
So one point I'm going to interrupt, Chris, that just comes to mind about Pac-Land is that when I first played it, I thought it was a ripoff of Super Mario Brothers, you know, because you see it and it's like, okay, they threw Pac-Man in a side-scrolling platformer.
But why did they give him Space Invaders controls? I hate you, Pac-Man.
Yeah, it's weird. But it turns out, no, this predates Super Mario Brothers. And in fact, Super Mario Brothers may have been a ripoff of this game for all I know. There's this fluid scrolling and jumping and platforming and secrets and stuff you can reveal, which is amazing. And although there's a fairy, I think, at the end of every level that gives you some kind of ability that you use in the next level.
And she's also from the cartoon, right? The fairy?
I don't know about
the fairy. I do not remember the fairy.
Yeah, it's been a long time. Okay. I don't know.
I've thought Santa Claus was the only humanoid figure they encountered.
It's possible.
Yeah.
It could be that the fairy was totally made up here, and the fairy looks nothing like any other character in Pac-Man. She's like a Disney...
She's tall.
She looks like Sleeping Beauty. She's like... She's totally completely... Or maybe Cinderella. I don't know. But anyway, she's just like normally proportioned human and very detailed compared to all the Pac-Man sprites. Like, that's one of the things that really stands out about this game is that it has this very like animation-looking art style where it's like lots of, you know, characters with flat colors and black outlines... Mm-hmm. And then the backgrounds are kind of weird. They're sort of isometric and sort of not. So there's like this weird element of abstraction. But
then the fairy comes along and has a 100 colors.
And she's like in this field of flowers. Mm-hmm. It's extremely like detailed.
That you
busy.
Get to by jumping through a hole in space.
Yeah, that
like
that
a floating tesseract.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. This game's weird.
Is he jumping into Video Land and suddenly becoming part of Kid Video? Is that what's happening?
That's what it looks like.
Aha. Uh-huh.
I think.
So we've got the MCU happening for video game cartoons, just not for video games.
I think it is really interesting that they, like, clearly you don't make Pac-Man and not realize that it is the best thing you've made, right? It's like Pac-Man is
certainly,
still...
You certainly don't rake in hundreds of millions of dollars and not realize, oh, this is a great thing.
So they keep trying to do different things with the Pac-Man brand that, you know, the long and winding road that leads to Pac-Man 2 is kind of starting here. But it's so weird to look at this and try and figure out what they're thinking. The power-ups you get are hats and boots, which I love because those are the two things Pac-Man can have. He's a head with legs.
That's what he wears in the cartoons.
Yeah. I think it's the idea of traveling through a stage, then going into this weird Pontulist Monet painting. Monet or Manet?
Well, there's two artists. There's Monet and there's Manet.
Yeah, I know. Which one am I thinking of?
If you're thinking of Pointillism, that was Seurat. That wasn't even one of them.
Oh, well, sorry. Okay then.
Yeah.
You're thinking Monet of Impressionist. Was abstract and Manet was more, not abstract, but yeah, it was Impressionist. And then Manet was more like a naturalist that kind of painted a lot of figures, lots of naked women sitting in the grass.
Yeah, that's what this is.
My kind of painting.
Yeah. And then you travel, you go in there, and then you commune with this higher being, and then you travel backwards through the stage you just went through, which is a really interesting mechanic.
Yeah, I mean, Bungie totally ripped that off for Halo.
I refer to it as the inverted castle of Pac-Land.
It's the library. It's definitely like the Halo library.
It's really interesting. And also, like, it's another one of those games where each level, the background has changed. So it starts in daytime and then you get sunset and then you get night. So there's this weird time progression. There's a lot of weird ideas in this game.
It's really ambitious. And like, I've never made it this far, but looking ahead at some videos, there are stages that are basically you're traveling through a hidden, like, obscure area, and you can only see, like, a limited distance.
Yeah,
it's kind of like a bonus stage where you have to, like, just make it through a maze. And they use, you know, like, a foreground background layer. So they cover up the screen with a foreground layer, except where Pac-Man's, you know, like, his cone of vision is. And then you can see the platforms ahead of you, and you have to kind of find your way through this maze, which you can't see the entirety of it. So it's, there's a lot happening here.
This is the other thing is, I've mentioned this in the notes for some other game we haven't covered yet, but there's a lot of these games where they put so much work into it, so much detail that most people never saw because the game is so hard.
Mm-hmm.
I actually have played Pac-Land, I swear, 100 times. I never saw the fairy one time. I never got to the fairy, the end of one stage. So I had no idea you can turn invisible and get boots and jump higher or whatever.
Fly.
Do all this stuff. I mean, geez,
yep.
They put a lot of work into this.
They did, and then they hit it behind really difficult game.
Wanting quarters, I guess. You
know? There are also, like, ghosts driving cars, because ghosts mm-hmm. themselves are not scary enough. They need to have cars and airplanes.
Yeah.
Yeah, the idea of, like, guys driving cars in a side-scroller as a hazard, that's very Alex Kidd. Like, Sega totally borrowed from Pac-Land when they made Alex Kidd.
We've discovered Pac-Land is like the Genesis
it is,
of platformers.
But it never showed up on Genesis, which is really weird.
Yeah, it should have. Pac-Man 2 did, though.
It did.
But it had like a mouse interface. I don't remember.
No, it wasn't mouse, but
like a mouse.
It was mouse-esque.
Yeah.
Pac-Land's fascinating.
It is
not fun.
And
unfortunately.
It still keeps the element of collecting energizers.
Mm-hmm. This is.
And if you find an energizer, you can devour the ghosts, the monsters. And you can get more than 1,600 points because more than four appear at a time. So you can keep going. 3,200 points, 6,400 points if you're good. It's like a revolution. It's the score chase. My God.
I also really like that the levels, the demarcation between the levels is a giant billboard that says break time, which I think we need in this room. You need a big break time sign.
Neon lights.
For when it's break time.
And pretty, pretty girls.
I was just going to say, I think this is like the most important, least understood game we've probably ever talked about. Something that I can.
No, we've done Heianchio Alien.
Other than that.
So let's dial back the time machine from 1984 to 1983, going way back in time, to talk about Fozon, which was a really strange game, according to my notes, that never left Japan. It involves molecular science. You are trying to capture molecules to recreate a pattern that you're given in advance while avoiding roaming atoms. It's strange. Mm-hmm. It's a really high concept kind of video game. Like, it's, you know, they're basically saying, like, hey, it's molecular chemistry, the arcade game. That's unusual.
I mean, it's more like just pattern matching.
It is, but I mean the presentation of it,
yeah. I actually really liked this game.
Okay.
I played it for the first time after we brought it up when we did the last Namco episode, and I found it to be shockingly enjoyable. I think this could be like a mobile game today that people would play on their phones constantly.
So when you played this, was it on a collection or did you just like emulate
it? I just got it on the emulator because it looked interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's really, it's shallow, but it has a very interesting set of mechanics where you can, each kind of stray atom you pick up for your molecule is added onto the outer layer of whatever angle you hit it at. And if you get the wrong one, you basically have to fire off atoms in rotating order, which occasionally sends you back to just having the core nucleus. And so there's a lot of dodging, collecting the thing you don't want to get in addition to dodging the bad things. It's really interesting. It was super fun. I'd never heard of it before.
I have never played it, but you speak highly of it, so maybe it's not so bad.
Yeah, if Namco just wants to drop this one onto the old App Store, I think they could do it.
I feel like this was probably on the first Namco collection, and when it came out, I was like, "What is Fozon?" Or one of them, one, two, or three? I know that there's five of them, right? And then they're NAMCO,
right? And there's a trademark in Japan also, Namco Museum Encore.
Extra one.
That was where the good stuff was.
Yeah.
I don't know. I had never played Fozon. I have never played Fozon. I've watched videos of it, and it's kind of hard to wrap my head around, but I will have to check it out now that you've spoken highly of it.
I think looking at it you'll get it immediately if you're playing it, but I think it is probably the most boring thing in the world to watch.
Right. Mm-hmm. And good puzzle games often are like that. Yeah. So I guess that's fair.
Why are all those bricks falling?
All right. So that was the end of 1983. And now we'll go back to 1984 and talk about one of the big ones here, although only in Japan, really. Tower of Druaga, which is one of Namco's really big games, maybe the last super huge classic game on this entire list. And Tower of Druaga was basically Namco's attempt to jump into the action RPG genre around the same time that Falcom created Dragon Slayer. You had games like Adventure and Venture in the US. And this was Namco's attempt to take that and apply it to a sort of Pac-Man style maze chase and make it an arcade experience. And it's huge and ambitious and really complex for an arcade game. And it kind of amazes me that this was published, because this really feels like the kind of game you would play at home. And I think
console game.
Yeah. And I think that accounts for why it was such a big game on Famicom when it came out. This was one of Namco's big breakout titles in the home space, because, you know, they'd published some other home ports like Pac-Man, Galaxian. But then Tower Druaga came to Famicom, I want to say in early 1985, and there wasn't anything else like it on any home, you know, home console at that time. And this was a game that I think really was extremely well suited for home play, because it is so huge and there are so many secrets. And it's so taxing and demanding that, you know, in the arcades, it's like this is a 60-level tower that you have to climb, and it's full of secrets and really difficult.
Yeah, how the heck will you ever see all that stuff?
Right.
This is the one I was talking about where there's so much content buried behind that difficulty level. I could not believe when I watched the YouTube video about it recently, all the stuff, every one of those levels has its own artifact with its own effect, and they all build up.
Yes.
And then, you've got these crazy enemies flying at you, and geez, I can't believe they.
That is the wild thing about this game, is that it is a 60-level maze, and again, it's in the style of Pac-Man, but the mazes are a little bigger than Pac-Man mazes. They scroll somewhat, and every level has a secret contained within an item that Gilgamesh, the hero, can collect. But the thing is that each secret is revealed in a different way. All 60 stages have a secret that is hidden in a different way than every other secret in every other level. So you have to figure out not only what is the secret of this level, but you have to figure out what is the secret to find the secret. And it's always going to be different. It's like, kill three enemies. Okay, that's easy. Hit a wall. Sure. But then you get to really obscure stuff. And it's like, kill, you know, only this one enemy in the stage. How are you supposed to know that? Well, obviously, you're not going to figure it out your first time. This was really a game built around the communal aspect of arcades, where people would share secrets and say, well, you know, like
share tips,
sell strategy guides.
Play.
I mean, strategy guides existed in Japan in a way that they didn't in the US here. Like, you know, in the early 80s, you had Jeff Rovin books on, you know, how to get high scores at Pac-Man or whatever. But But in Japan, they actually had, you know, full strategy guides. I think beginning with, yes, that's right, Hey Onkyo Alien. There were like magazine guides, you know, written on strategies and that sort of thing for Hey Onkyo Alien in the 70s. And that led to this kind of cottage industry of video game strategy guides, standalone guides dedicated to a single game. So Tower of Daraga was built very much around that sort of sharing and conversing about games, like, you know, sharing secrets the same way that Mortal Kombat did 10 years later in America. Like, what's the combo to perform the fatality?
That was fun.
That was exactly what Tower of Daraga was pulling into, except in, you know, the context of a role-playing game.
Yeah. So, the one thing I'd like to say about Tower of Daraga the most is it struck me how similar Zelda is to this.
Oh, yeah.
Cannot believe there's even these wizards that teleport around and shoot mm-hmm. beams at you and stuff. And I mean, there's no question that Zelda is inspired by this game.
Oh, yeah.
Just like the Pac-Man, Pac-Land, Super Mario Brothers connection. I mean, Nintendo must have been looking directly at Namco's works and saying, how can we iterate on this or bring
Namco
it home?
Was a superstar in the Famicom. Their games were, in some cases, selling better than Nintendo's own games. So, yeah, I have zero doubts that Nintendo was looking at what Namco was doing and saying, like, what are they, you know, how are they having all this success on our platform? Mm-hmm. Let's copy that.
Yeah.
And I feel like in you know, both of these cases, what Nintendo came up with was much, much better than what Namco came up with. But there's still something to be said for Namco getting there first and
pioneering,
doing something really cool that had not been done before.
Yeah, I think they pioneered them and Nintendo kind of perfected them, you know.
I feel like Tower of Daraga is to Pac-Man what Super Mario Brothers is to Mario Brothers. Like, it takes this very simple kind of setup and basic idea and then just expands it into a whole different genre. I don't think Tower of Daraga is as good as Super Mario Brothers.
Sure.
And I certainly don't think Mario Brothers is as good as Pac-Man. But I feel like the expansion to 60 levels, 60 secrets, here's a bunch of stuff going on, different enemies. That is exactly the kind of expansion that you see going into, you know, taking that single screen adventure and then exploding it into whatever 8x4 is.
Epic.
32 stages.
Tower of Daraga was hugely influential, not just on Zelda, but if you look at series like Ys or Hydlide, that the same kind of control mechanic where Gilgamesh is not a Link-style slasher sword kind of guy. He has a sword and a shield, and your shield is up and raised if you're not attacking, and it can block projectiles from enemies. So in order to attack, you have to lower your sword, and you can't slash with it. You put it out kind of slowly, and then you walk forward. So you're like holding out your shield and kind of defenseless as you approach an enemy. So it doesn't lend itself to like super fast actions and reflexes, which I think is not really fair because there are a lot of enemies who materialize and warp around, and it's really hard and not entirely fair.
I found that really frustrating about this game. It's not, you expect it to be like Zelda where you're just hitting it and hitting, but you have to
play it a different way.
Yeah.
Like it is much more like the East Hydlide style where you're kind of running into enemies and you have to hit them at just the right angle. Otherwise you take damage. So it's pretty challenging that way, but this game was so like such a huge hit and it continues to reverberate through Namco's catalog. I think it was it Tales of Destiny? One of the Tales of games had its own Tower of Daraga where you took, you know, the core mechanics of that game, of the Tales game, and traveled through a recreation of the Tower of Daraga. Maybe it was Baten Kaitos. I can't remember, but it's definitely shown up. And then, you know, they've made a lot of sequels. There's this entire series that follows on from Tower of Daraga, and I kind of fell in love with it with Nightmare of Daraga for PlayStation 2, which I don't know if you guys ever played.
I think I have that. Actually.
That was the roguelike adaptation.
Yeah. I have,
and
that was
my introduction to roguelikes, and it was really hard, and I really liked it.
It's cool though. Yeah, I found that at a used game store about 10 years ago, and I was like, wow, what is this?
And that game and
played it.
That game also keeps the, you know, each stage has a secret. Mm-hmm. And in the Japanese version, there's a little hint that you get for finding the stage. And they didn't bother to translate that for the US. It was just like out of their budget for localization. So they didn't bother. So the American game is much, much harder because you have no idea how to find the secrets in that game. But I still like it. And actually, why don't we jump ahead to 1986, I think? Or what
was that? Where's my flux?
Yes. Ishtar, that was one of the first sequels. Actually, I think it was the first sequel to Tower of Draga. And you can really see a difference, you know, just in 2 years of how game presentation and design has changed, because Tower of Draga is this very sort of dense Pac-Man style maze, whereas Return of Ishtar is expanded quite a bit. There's, you know, the maze is no longer just like two screens large. It's now huge and scrolls in many directions, and there's a lot more space to navigate around enemies. It's not quite so punishing. You move more quickly. And the concept of Return of Ishtar is really cool. So Tower of Draga has you climbing a 60-level tower to fight Draga, the evil demon that has kidnapped the princess Kai. So at the end of the game, you rescue Kai. Hooray, Draga is defeated. The Return of Ishtar has you traveling back down the tower, all 60 levels, kind of like Pac-Land, actually. And this time you are playing as Gilgamesh the Knight, and also as Kai. In fact, Kai is the main character, and Gilgamesh is like a companion. The second player can play as Gilgamesh, but the screen is always centered around Kai, which is kind of a strange design choice.
But
you can also play single player and kind of activate Gilgamesh as like a support character from time to time. So it's a really interesting concept. It's like I wrote that it's maze-like, but not in a Pac-Man way. So you can definitely feel the influence of, you know, kind of other games that had come along since Tower of Draga in this one. And the co-op element is pretty interesting. I feel like it's maybe kind of getting to what they wanted to do with Pac-Pal, but failed. And it's getting closer to it. I don't know if they quite pull it off, but it's getting closer. So it's a pretty interesting game. Have you guys ever played it?
Maybe. I don't remember
exactly. That is the confidence Return I love to hear.
Ishtar.
I have not. I just watch videos of it because I find games in this vein, like honestly, up to and including the original Legend of Zelda, I find very frustrating to play. Zelda, I think, is, you know, more fun for me because it's a little more action oriented.
Something interesting occurred to me, which is that if Tower of Draga is influenced by Pac-Man, and Zelda's influenced by Tower of Draga, then Zelda's actually a Pac-Man game.
That's like saying...
That's why there's fairies. They took the fairies from Pac-Land.
Right. It's all making sense. Okay. Where does the Illuminati come in?
I feel like I've got the red strings on the board behind me.
Okay, so also in 1984, you have another very influential Namco game, though I think one that is not quite as beloved as Tower of Draga, and that is Dragon Buster. You guys ever played this one? It's been on a bunch of their collections. I think it made it to NES.
Yes.
So, great. Then why don't you talk about it? Because I've been talking a lot.
I think that it's frustrating. I wanted it to be awesome, and the first time I ever saw this is probably on a Namco collection or something. I thought, wow, it's great. It's an action RPG, sort of side view of a person instead of top down like Tower of Draga, and you're slashing and you're doing interesting strategy movements. And then I'm like, the other thing is, I was thinking Zelda 2 is definitely inspired by this. So yeah, there you go, Nintendo.
Well, I feel like Dragon Buster inspired a lot of games. If you look at Rasten Saga or Rygar or Wonder Boy 2 and Zelda 2, like all of these sort of side-scrolling fantasy sword-based melee combat games really feel like they took a lot. Well, I guess Rygar's not sword-based.
You got that shield thing.
It's a disc armor, but whatever, in your heart, it's a sword. like all of these games kind of feel like they came out of Dragon Buster. And I feel like around the same time, just as Tower of Draga showed up around the same time as Dragon Slayer, I feel like this showed up around the same time as Xanadu, Dragon Slayer 2, and they have a very similar style. So it's kind of interesting because you have Falcom on the PC side and Namco on the arcade side kind of doing the same thing in different ways. Like Namco being on the arcade side, put together games with quicker action and much more impressive graphics. Even though, Chris, I see you wrote that Dragon Buster has arguably one of the worst sprites you've ever seen.
I hate it. I hate the way this game looks.
You hate it?
I hate it. Wow.
That's pretty strong.
I think it looks... Look, I think the game itself is like... You mentioned in the notes, it's like cheap and difficult. Like very...
It is really cheap and hard. But that was in terms of like the design, not so much the graphics.
Yeah. I think it's a tough game to play. I hate the way it looks.
Really?
Yes. The head is weird on the sprite, so it looks like his head's on backwards when he's walking to the right. The attack action looks really weird. It actually, the attack action is very close to what we're going to see much later in the extremely weird Genji and Heike clans.
Yeah, don't bring that up yet. It's a whole other thing.
With the weird windmilling. I do not like the way this game looks.
It's
tough to play, and I hate looking at it.
I can sympathize. There are a lot of those sort of janky animations that are just not that great.
But you have to look at what else was coming out in 1984 in arcades and compare this to that.
And you're like, this is advanced.
This is baby steps. Mm-hmm. This is transitional. But come on, compare this to like what else was there in 1984 that even compared to this?
Well, look.
Nothing.
Dragon's Lair? Come on, that's not fair. Well,
look,
I guess
84 was an arcade lull. It was a real lull before.
I think the graphics in Kung Fu are much better,
right?
Because they are much more representative.
But that was also based on Jackie Chan, so of course it's going to look great
naturally. But I honestly think, for as much as they did a lot of innovative stuff, I kind of think this might be a controversial statement. I kind of feel like bad graphics are a Namco trademark.
Wow, okay.
Like, Galaga looks good.
Yeah, Pac-Man, that is a real, real stinker.
Well, look, yeah, Pac-Man is very representative. Perfect. But look at Pac-Lit.
What is he representing?
He represents a circle.
Okay.
Pizza.
With a missing triangle of various sizes.
Pizza.
But look at what happens when they try to make Pac-Man into the side-scrolling character. They're using the designs from the show, obviously, which are bad. But the design that they have in Pac-Land is not a good translation of Pac-Man.
But I'm telling you, like, in 1984, people were not making games that looked that good.
I think, you know, if you look at it from a historical point of view, I agree with Jeremy. But retrospectively, I agree with Chris, which is that looking backward, these games look terrible.
You can't have it both ways, Benj.
Don't
be so lukewarm.
There's more than one part of Benj. It's a mini spectrum.
Wow. You have layers like an onion.
Yeah, I am. Yeah.
I just hate the way this game looks so much.
I think.
The enemies look, the backgrounds are nauseating.
Just go take a sledgehammer to an arcade and get this over with. Just catharsis.
Okay, well, what I will say in Dragon Buster's defense is that it is a proto-Metroidvania game.
Yep.
You're getting into the idea of a world that exists as a place. This is a game that has multiple paths to the end. So basically, each stage consists of multiple subsections, and you choose which subsection you go to from an overhead map, and it's linear. Like if you go from like point A to B, you can't go back to point A and then go to point C instead. You have to move on to point D. So it's whatever route, but you kind of commit to a route and there's branching paths. And the further you get into the game, the more complex the paths get. And at the end of each path, in each stage, there's ultimately a castle where a dragon waits. And you have to go fight the dragon because you're busting dragons. That is what you do. You're a dragon buster.
Mm-hmm. And busting makes you feel
good.
It does.
This is
also the dragon
looks
human terrible.
Whipping things with your arm. With a weapon in your arm. I mean,
you have a sword, but yes, it works like a whip.
I feel like this is a precursor to Castlevania.
Right. Well, I mean, this is a precursor to Bloodstained. Sword or whip, why not both?
Yeah.
Okay, so anyway, there are some good ideas here, and it was a super influential game, and also it's not a lot of fun to play now.
Yeah.
It's also kind of ugly. Yeah.
It's terrible. But it's very important.
But you know what is a good game? And that's Gapless, also known as Galaga 3. I don't know what's called Galaga 3 because there was no Galaga 2. But here we are. Galaga 3.
Wait a minute.
I could see if they called it Mappy. Galaxian 3, but Galaxian 3 is a different game.
Mappy was Galaga 2.
Okay. Anyway, Gapless. I think that's like GA Galaga Plus. Okay.
Oh.
So this is the game that puts the shoe on the other foot in space. You are the little Galaga fighter. You're flying around, by which I mean sitting at the bottom of the screen moving left and right. And there's enemy formations that appear at the top. You know, it's got that Space Invaders Galaxian thing going on. They'll swoop down in formation and attack you. But this time, the enemies don't capture you. No, this is Soviet Russia, and you capture the enemies. That's how it goes, right?
Yes.
Something like that.
In Soviet Russia, you capture enemy. There you go. So, yeah, that's the entire concept here. You know, the idea in Galaga was the Galaga flagships could come down and they could steal your fighter and you sacrifice a life. And, oh, my God, it's terrible. They caught my fighter. But when the Galaxian Galaga, whatever it was called, that had your fighter swoop down, you could shoot it and reclaim your fighter. And then you had double firepower. Well, this time you don't have to sacrifice your ship because you're like, no assholes. Now I have a tractor beam too. So when the bad guys come at you, you can capture them. There's, you know, some limits and restrictions on this, but then you force a little bug ship to be your friend. You're like, you have to fight the bad guys now. Go kill your brethren. It's pretty dark.
It is extremely good.
Yeah.
It is an extremely good mechanic.
It is.
That's just humiliating to those bug creatures.
Bugs have no emotions.
Are you sure about that?
All they care about is like vomiting honey, I swear.
I saw a praying mantis crying.
Well, I mean, they pray, so
that's true.
They're a very sensitive.
I haven't played a lot of Hollow Knight lately.
No, I was playing this not that long ago, and the shooting sound effect just grated at me in such an insane way I couldn't play it anymore. There's something about it. I just
were you playing on like a collection or on an emulator?
An emulator.
Okay, sometimes emulators have some issues.
They're
with
missing
sound.
A channel or something. Yeah,
yeah. I don't remember this having grating sound effects, but I do know that it is still pretty challenging.
I love this though because it's taking this thing that worked super well, which in this case Galaga, and then tweaking an element of it and reversing an element of it in the way that they keep trying to do with Pac-Man.
Yeah,
but in this case, it really works.
It's it's a fun inversion of the mechanic.
Yeah,
and I don't know if there's actually a limit to how many ships you can capture. There's a video that I linked here that you guys watched, I hope, where the person was clearly using a cheat code because enemy projectiles just passed right through his ships. But he has like five enemy ships linked up beside him, so he's basically just like this wall of death destroying everything. But I don't think it's really possible to do that in the game.
I did watch that video and I was wondering, I was like, wait, can't be killed?
He was extremely cheating. Okay. It was like pure ups cheat code.
Cause it's pretty great.
But like, that's a fun reason to use a cheat code right there. Just to have five alien servants destroying their own brethren because they want to blow up Earth. And that's not cool.
Yeah, and now you've got the army that goes all the way across the screen.
Mm.
All right. So anyway, I can't say that every sequel to a Namco classic was a great sequel, like Super Zevius. I have no idea what makes this different than Zevius. It is, as far as I can tell, exactly the same game. Do you guys know otherwise?
It's like Super, like it's above it in time. So that's why they call it Super Zevius. No, I came to the same conclusion.
This is the game
what
that owns
is so
Zevius's
super
apartment.
About this? It's something that's lost on us at the moment.
Okay.
He's a super.
So there might be something to this game that I'm missing, but I've played it and I'm like, it's Zevius.
Zevius. Maybe it was on a different colored arcade cabinet that was different controls on it, maybe different configuration. You know,
more Nazca lines. I don't know.
Just re-released. Yeah. More
okay,
promptus.
So that was not a good follow-up or meaningful follow-up to Zevius.
Yeah.
But Grobda, on the other hand, is very interesting because Grobda is a game in which you play as one of those little tanks that drives around on the ground in Zevius that your main character bombs all the time. But this time, instead of being just, you know, cannon fodder to die, you are the hero. and you are shooting bad guys, even though you're also a bad guy. It's very confusing.
Yeah.
It's kind of like Aeon Flux, that episode where it's like following the perspective of one character and then the character kills another character and you follow the character that killed them. No?
I can't get past the name of Grobda.
That's a deep cut, Jeremy.
It is, but do you remember that episode?
I do not remember that episode.
Okay, it's like it's following Aeon a character Flux, around yeah. through this battle and then they get killed and it shifts to the perspective of the person who killed them and it keeps doing that throughout the episode.
That sounds like a very good gimmick.
It's a pretty great episode.
I feel like I've seen that.
Probably.
I think I did.
Because it probably blew your mind and you were like, this is amazing.
This is just like Grobda, man.
So that's what's going on here. This is the Peter Chang cartoon of Zevius.
What's the deal with the name Grobda?
Yeah, I was going to say, you figured
that's
out
the name
Gapples.
Of the tank. The tank is called a Grobda.
Grobda. You know, it's why not? Backwards, it's Adborg. That would have been a lot better.
I mean, that is like you are trying. They tried to assimilate you through commercial products.
So it's like life in 2018.
Basically, yes.
We have nothing meaningful to say about this, obviously, because it's I don't know about the Grobdas, the Gapluses, and
Grobda has been on a couple of collections. It's not a timeless classic, but it's okay, and I think it's Zevius' connection. And by the way, this is what I was talking about with the MCU connection with Namco, because they have all these games like Zevius that have these kind of running storylines through them. There's the whole Mr. Driller universe. I swear to God, we did a whole episode on it. It's crazy.
Yeah. Well, how does Mr. Driller fit into Grobda? Is he driving the tank?
I don't think he does, but he does fit into Baraduke, which is later.
Okay, cool.
But anyway, yeah, so Grobda is like, it's kind of like combat, you know, for Atari or the tank game in Tron, the tank mode, in that you have this tank, it can drive around and shoot in 8 directions, and you have a very, very weak shield that can very briefly protect you against enemy fire.
I think.
And you have to watch out for shrapnel, because when you blow things up, they explode. And if you're caught within the circle of the explosion, that will destroy you too. But you can create like chain reactions with enemies, which is cool. So there's kind of some good stuff going on here. It is a pretty repetitive game. Like I've played, you know, the first few stages of it, and then I've watched a video all the way up through stage 99 or whatever, and it's all pretty much the same except harder. So not a lot happening.
Is this the one? One of them I thought would be good with as a twin stick shooter, like if you could move in one direction and shoot in the other, but apparently you can't. It's just a single thing and you can lost opportunity.
Yeah, I don't know about that one. I never played it in the arcade. I've only played it on collections. I also can't speak to the question you've raised in the next game, moving on to 1985, which is Sky Kid. Chris, you want to explain why you can shoot the happy dancing women and turn them into pink poop emojis?
I would love to have someone explain this to me. Sky Kid, first of all, it's a full-on war game where you need to bomb enemy encampments, which is a much darker theme than Sky Kid.
Well, and on top of that, the Sky Kid is actually a bird. He is a bird flying a biplane. What? If you look at the character art for the characters here.
Are you sure it's just not just bad art?
No.
Are you sure he's not a goat?
The official like art in the manual, Sky Kid is like a blue jay or something wearing a bomber jacket and a helmet. And then all the bad guys are also animals. But they're like, you know, anthropomorphic animals. They're furries.
I guess that's a better concept than what I thought this was, which is that it was just a child soldier.
Mm-hmm. That's how they got out of the darkness, I think. Yeah. They said, okay, it's all about bombing stuff and destroying enemy encampments. Why don't we just put animals in it instead and it'll be great?
So you're flying around. You got to pick up a bomb and then you take the bomb somewhere and you drop it and murder a bunch of animal
sleeping
people,
soldiers.
I guess. And then you get to a place where you need to land and there's these three like happy dancing ladies to indicate where you need to land. And you can shoot them.
How do you know that? Why would you ever shoot those ladies?
I didn't shoot the ladies.
They're like, super happy that you're landing safely after completing a mission.
That explains the pink poop. Okay.
I was merely a witness to this literal war crime. Mm-hmm. But yeah, then they turn into things. There's a sequel to Sky Kid where they turn into
Sky
cats.
Goat.
Sky Goat, where they Super Sky Goat, where they turn into cats. I don't know what they're supposed to be, but they look like the poop emoji, but pink.
Do they talk like Patrick Stewart, though?
Oh, why? Jeremy, would you remind me of the existence of
sometimes
the emoji movie?
We have to remember that there are worse things to come out of Star Trek The Next Generation than the Beverly Crusher candle sex candle episode.
I love
would
that
watch
episode.
The sex candle episode 60 times in a row before I would watch the emoji movie once.
There are worse things.
I love that episode.
Are you?
I don't know why you're always picking on it. It's the greatest episode
garbage.
Of all time. It's like a it romance novel.
It's like super
but they
bad.
Solve the problem, don't they? So it's like
well,
good.
That's okay.
Don't
then.
They? Yeah, you're
okay,
they're
we
saving
got, we
somebody.
We got like really
they're
sidetracked
helping.
Here, but I will say that I hate that episode with every fiber of my being. I make fun of it because that's the only way to make the hurting go away.
It might be the worst episode of Next Generation.
It's the worst episode of Star
it
Trek.
It might be. But oof.
People
even,
are like, I don't know, Turnabout Intruder, pretty bad. But, you know, something like Threshold, people are like, oh, that's the worst Star Trek episode ever. No, I don't care if Captain Janeway and Tom Paris turned into lizards and had babies. At least it was consensual. Okay, it's cool that Gates McFadden gets a highlight episode. It's bad that that's her highlight episode.
Oh, okay.
Directed by Jonathan Frakes.
When you look at it that
oh,
way.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it was one of the Frakes episodes.
Two takes Frakes. What's going on?
So, man. No, I enjoyed
I'm
it.
I'm sorry. This is totally... I think
we might be done with
thing.
Namco.
We got to talk about Metro Cross.
Nothing
right?
in Namco is as bad as what was that episode called? I don't even know. Just the sex candle episode. Sex
yeah, candle. Bev has a Bev's family has been Isn't having sex with a ghost for 600 years. The episode. Yeah. Metro Cross is fun.
Yeah, Metro Cross. So talk about Metro Cross, because it's really a game ahead of its time.
It really is.
It is like an iPhone endless runner that came out 25 years before those existed.
Yeah.
With That's
a
pretty
weird,
great.
With a weird like Running Man. Like yeah. It's like they heard the title of the movie, The Running Man, and knew it was set in a dystopian future right. where someone was doing something for the entertainment of others. And they were like, got it, running.
Yeah. So
they accidentally set it in a vending machine where you're jumping over Coke cans.
That's the really weird thing.
Yeah. It's quite good. My main experience with this is watching the two-part Game Center CX episode.
Two parts,
where Arino is very frustratingly bad at this game.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
he will not go for the ramps.
It is a really tough game, and watching YouTube plays of people who know the game really well is amazing because they've like memorized where all the jumps are. So this is a game. It's auto-scrolling. You are a little dude running, and there's like these patches of blue on the ground that'll slow you down. And then you can jump over them either by jumping or by hitting springboards that'll fling you over them. You have to collect blue Coke cans and jump over red Coke cans. I think they're supposed to be something else, but they look like Coke.
Gotta
cans.
Get that Pepsi. Avoid the Coke.
Right?
Newbern, North Carolina's own Pepsi Cola.
So that's pretty much all there is to it. It's just like a game where you're running a whole lot. And it's
later,
okay.
Later, you get to ride a skateboard.
Oh, I didn't know that. I've never made it that far.
I saw in advance of the videos that people were playing.
This game almost got a sequel on Xbox 360 and PS3. I interviewed, Hideo Yoshizawa, the director of Klonoa and Mr. Driller back in like 2011. And I was at Namco's offices. And so after the interview, we talked for like an hour. He was like, I want to show you something. So he like booted up a PS3 debug and he played this like, you know, 3D version, basically like a remake of Metro Cross that was going to come out, and it never did. And I've always been disappointed that never happened.
Maybe that's
so I got to like play this game that never came out, like a crazy. Why would they do this remake of Metro Cross? But it happened. Wow. I guess the question, like, why would they do this is they didn't do this.
Was it going to be like a dark reimagining, like that Bionic Commando game
it was
where
not,
the arm is the gun?
It was not like, it was not Bomberman Act Zero. It was just like a super happy, cheerful
darn, it's beer
Metro Cross that happened to be. Yeah, that's right. It's Jolt Cola.
These cans are blood cans.
Beer. That's in beer. That's funny enough, isn't it?
It is funny.
Okay, good.
But no, blood, it was just going to be like...
Cans of blood.
Okay.
That's the re-reimagining.
Right. Okay. Yeah, it was just going to be like a super happy, cheerful reimagining of... Or not even a reimagining, just remake of Metro Cross. But they never followed through with it.
Does Namco have like a big mobile gaming presence in the way that Konami has moved to the exclusion of everything else?
Well, they certainly haven't moved to mobile gaming to the exclusion of everything else, but I think they do pretty well on mobile.
Because, again, I feel like this game, like, again, it's an endless runner from the mid-80s. Like, it could absolutely... And it honestly looks good enough that it could be... I know I said bad graphics were a trademark. That was an exaggeration. But this game could just be, like, on your phone now. Like, this and Fozon, I think, would be very easy, fun games to have on mobile.
So you like the two weirdest Namco games?
I really do.
Weird games are great.
I know.
Who doesn't love weird games?
That's true. That's the Sega episode. It's all about that.
Yes. So we'll kind of wind down. I know this is a pretty short episode, but in fairness, our last episode was way longer than it was supposed to be. So if you average them out, you're getting just the normal amount of content. So let's talk about a couple more games. Motos, which, Chris, I think this is also a game that would work really well as a mobile. In fact, it's not a mobile game. Well, yes, it actually did come out on iOS, but Motos is basically recreated as a mini game in The World Ends With You. I don't know if you've ever played that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So like that pin battle game, that is Motos.
Mm-hmm.
So you are like a little thing, and you bump into other little things and try to knock them off a platform. It's just like a simple physics platformer. It kind of reminds me of, you know, those little octopus dudes in the Legend of Zelda, A Link to the Past, you're like on kind of in the Tower of Hera, where you're on all these floors that have holes in them. And there's these little like shelled octopus things that come after you and you hit them and you like cause them to bounce into these pads and then they'll fall off, or maybe you'll fall off.
I was trying to figure out why this was stressing me out so much. Yeah. It's because it reminds me of the Tower of Hera.
Yeah. It's very much, it's like the entire Tower of Hera was turned into a video game that stands alone.
I've also played in Mario Party. There's a bunch of, I swear every Mario Party game has a mini game like this where Mario's on a bunch of beach balls or something, Mario and all the friends, and you have to knock everybody else off, and it's just a one stick kind of game.
I think Motos is a great example of something that could exist as a standalone game 30 years ago, and now it's like, well, there's not really that much to it. Kind of like Metro Cross. It just needs to be something, part of something that's bigger.
I actually really like the jumping mechanics in this, where you can shatter the tiles and how you can, like, there are certain enemies that will chase you to try and knock you off. And if you jump over a gap, like, you can lure them into eliminating themselves, which is really fun. Like, I think there's, again, not a whole lot of depth, but some good touches to the Tower of Hera battle.
All right, so now we should talk on, maybe wrap this up by talking about the Nintendo Versus Unisystem. Are you guys familiar with the Versus Unisystem?
No.
Yes.
Binge, why don't you talk about it a little?
Don't remember.
So you're not familiar with it.
Yeah, well, is it the one where there's two screens on either side? Is this the red tent one?
That's one iteration of it, yes.
Let's see. I don't know. I think if it's the one I'm thinking of, then you have two sets of controls and two monitors, and you can play either a game where both characters are on the same screen at the same time, or each character can have their own view. You know, each player has their own view on the game, which is really neat. And I think there's a Wrecking Crew one that I've always wanted to play, because I swear you can play two players simultaneous on it or something.
I think so, yeah.
Anyway.
So the Versus Unisystem, the idea there was that it was Nintendo's version of basically like the Neo Geo, but before the Neo Geo, it was kind of the Data East Deco system, where you have a standard piece of hardware, in this case, based on the Famicom, the NES hardware. It's like boosted NES hardware, slightly stronger, better picture processing unit, etc. But pretty much an NES. And it's in the arcade, and you can plug and play with cartridges, like, you know, to different boards, I guess. So kind of a precursor to the PlayChoice 10, where you can swap out a game. So, like, you have tennis for a while, and people get sick of tennis. So you take out the tennis and put in Wrecking Crew and then slap new labels on the side of the board. So mostly these were Nintendo games, but third parties did get involved. And so you got these quote-unquote versus versions of NES games from third parties that didn't always have a versus component to them. Like, there was a versus Castlevania, which was not two-player simultaneous. It was just Castlevania.
Sorry, the red tent thing is the versus dual system.
Right.
So the unisystem is
an upright.
Yeah, an upright thing. And yeah, I guess it's like an NES in the arcade.
Mm-hmm. And some of these games were really different, like Balloon Fight. If you've ever played versus Balloon Fight, which you probably haven't because it's pretty uncommon, but it is going to come out on Switch pretty soon at some point, hopefully. That actually like has multiple level screens that scroll up and down, kind of like pinball. So some of these games were really different. Versus Excitebike is a completely different game than the NES game. Namco's games appear to be pretty much straight ports. There's Versus Sky Kid, which is Sky Kid.
Except the ladies turn into cats.
Except they turn into cats. There's Star Luster, which is basically, someone said it sounds not safe for work. That was probably Benj.
That was me, sorry.
It's basically a first-person space shooter with very primitive graphics, and it looks like Star Raiders.
The logo on this one is impossible to parse.
Yes. Versus Battle City, which is a combat-style tank game. Wow, there's a lot of notes on here that someone added.
Yeah, this is me. I said that it looks like if Wreck-It Ralph was exposed to the horrors of Modern Warfare. Because it's all like, the levels are like bubble bobble levels that you just tipped over and built a city out of.
Hmm.
So it's all smashing through bricks, but they don't ever really look like cities in the way that they're occasionally in the way that Bubble Bobble will have levels that look like the whale. Mm-hmm. Like this game does stuff like that.
Okay.
Ah.
I get it.
Yeah.
There's also levels with rivers that you can't cross that I thought looked like if you were playing Frogger as a tank, which would be a very good idea.
That would be cool. Tank Frogger.
Yeah.
Frogger
the Revenge.
Right. Frogda.
Nice. And then finally, Versus Super Zevius, which, okay, this is the NES version of Super Zevius, an arcade game in the arcade. So you could play Super Zevius, but you could also play the worse version. Hey,
yeah.
What do you want to do, guys?
That's weird. I still don't understand it. They just keep adding things onto the front of Zevius and hope it's a new game.
I guess.
Versus Super Zevius.
So finally, we're going to wrap up 1985 and Namco and this podcast by talking about Baraduk, also known as Alien Sector, which is a part of the Mr. Driller expanded universe.
Baraduke's like that big dog, right? And his owners can't really control him, and he's always getting up into stuff.
Correct.
Chasing the moment.
Baraduk stars none other than Mr. Driller's mom, Kissy. She's a space soldier named Kissy who flies around and rescues little happy guys
who say,
I'm your friendo.
Wait a minute. There's a woman in a space soldier suit fighting aliens. What does that sound like?
This is a year before Metroid.
Yeah. So there you go. Nintendo taking Namco.
I figured this one was alien inspired. Right? Like, it almost has to be, given what you're doing and the kind of look of it.
Maybe. I mean, by this point, Alien was 6 years old, and Aliens wasn't out yet. This is 1985, so I don't think it is. I think this was part of a general trend in Japanese games to say, like, hey, why don't we put a pretty girl as the protagonist instead of a dude? And it took a long time for Americans to catch on to that.
I actually think it's like very progressive for 1985.
Well, there was a trend.
Here's a mom.
We've talked about this to a degree on the podcast where you have stuff like Leta and a few other things, like anime from the mid-80s, where it's like, hey, here's a girl. Oh, her armor exploded. You can see her boobies now. Okay. So kind of jumping on that, but without the boobies.
It does seem like a woman in a full hazmat suit with a flamethrower is... going from that to Wonder Momo is a bit of a step backwards.
Yeah, definitely. So Bara Duke, you are Kissy. You are flying around. You have basically are taking a journey through these different sectors of space. And each stage is maybe like between 2 and 4 screens large. And you have to fly around and liberate aliens from capsules and save them. But you have to be careful because some capsules you shoot, they might give you a weapon upgrade. But some of them release these little like Pac-Man monsters that will chase you and you have to blow them up.
I thought they looked like if Pac-Man bonded with the Venom symbiote.
It's like, yeah, it's like Pac-Man with fangs.
Yeah.
That's scary.
How do you know she's Mr. Driller's mom?
It is part of the fiction. Well, actually, no. Mr. Driller Drillland brings it all together. She shows up in the parade at the end of the game. Like I swear to God, it's canon.
No, I believe you. She
married Dig Dug and they had a couple of kids. Ataru.
Pac-Man.
Ataru and Taizo. And Taizo Hori is Mr. Driller.
Well, who's Ataru?
That's Mr. Driller's older brother, who is basically the Racer X of Mr. Driller. He wears a scarf and he's very sullen and doesn't want to hang out with his family.
Okay.
I'm telling you, the MCU, like the closest video games have ever gotten to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, is the crazy backstories that Namco has invented to tie a bunch of their games together. No one else has bothered to do that.
Well, I mean, you say that, but you're basically talking about the amount of characters that exist in the Mario saga that are.
Yeah, but those are all Mario games. Yeah. These are games that. Dig Dug,
so this is like
Bara Duke, Mr. Driller. These had nothing to do with each other.
If you unite Metroid, Zelda, and Mario Brothers into the same universe
Luigi's
and marry them,
is very different from Mario World.
It is still a Mario game. It is undeniably a Mario game.
So if Mario and Samus had a baby, who would it be?
Let's not talk about that. That's disturbing.
It would be Link, obviously.
Link, there you go.
It'd be a Splatoon Squid Kid.
If Namco made it, they would do that.
Are the Splatoon kids Metroids?
Oh, God.
I don't believe so. They're squids, not octopi.
They're from the Mario game.
But there are the octopus creatures. Are they Metroids? You know what? We'll talk later.
I think maybe we're done here. I think it's time for this to end. This travesty of a podcast. No, it's been fun. We have certainly gone off topic. Anyway, so that takes us through 1985, and... getting into some kind of weird territory for Namco. It's not going to get any better next time. Well, no, that's not true. It'll get a little better. We've got Rolling Thunder next time.
Yeah, we're talking about Rolling Thunder and Wonder Momo. Those will at least be things to talk about.
Yeah, there'll be things to talk about.
So it's half good.
Anyway, so this has been our second look back at Namco. Next time we'll talk more about the games, like for longer. This was kind of a short episode because, like I said, we went too long on the last one and you guys need to drive home.
And it's 4:20.
Yes. So let's get going. Guys, where can we find you on the internet?
I'm Benj Edwards. You can find me on Twitter at Benj Edwards, where I'm currently building and selling custom-made artisanal joysticks like the BX-80.
And the BX-90, which I just purchased.
Yeah, the BX-90 for the NES and the BX-95 for the Genesis. And I just keep making new weird ones. Anyway, I also run VintageComputing.com, a blog. And Chris?
You can find pretty much everything that I do at the-isb.com. Including comics that I write, like the Army of Darkness comics and Marvel comics like Infinity Countdown Darkhawk and Infinity War Sleepwalker. And you can also find other podcasts that I do, which are many, and they are all linked on there.
All right. And I'm Jeremy Parrish doing Retronauts. You can find me at Retronauts.com, and Retronauts is at the Podcast One Network and on iTunes and so on and so forth. Listen for us. Yes. You can also support us through Patreon. Get these episodes a week early at a higher bitrate with no ads for only $3 a month, which is like, I don't know, 40 to 50 cents per episode. I think that is a pretty good deal. Like, what are you going to find these days that costs 50 cents? A Frosty. That's it. And that's a limited time only deal. Whereas Patreon, that's forever. So
Frosty doesn't have any Chris Sims in it.
Unless there was a bad accident.
There's a problem.
We had a problem back at the factory. Anyway.
Are we going to get blizzards? Is that the plan now?
I don't think
so. Anyway, so yeah, thanks for listening. And we'll be back in a week with another episode. Because because it's what we do. It's how we pair our villains. Thanks.